Good morning, Chairman, members of the board, the public. I'm Mike Plaziak, supervising geologist for the Victorville office of the Lahontan Water Board. I'm going to present this to you. I'm excited about this presentation. We have kind of a coordinated effort here, Water Board and Fish and Wildlife. So I'm excited, maybe not in the whole Christmas morning excitement, but still excited nonetheless. It's going to be a good presentation. It dovetails into what we provided to you back in September. This is part two, and we're going to talk about renewable energy, photovoltaics, and also wind energy. I talked to you last in September about the ramping up, the governor's proposal to get 33% of our energy production from renewables by 2020. Also, which is driving a lot of the projects that we're permitting. On top of that, the BLM and Department of Energy just issued a ROD back in October, which is putting out their whole plan on renewable energy in the California deserts and establishing solar energy zones. One of the things that you'll note, too, is outside of those solar energy zones, and there's primarily in Riverside and Imperial County, are other areas for investigation or study for other renewable energy projects. And that's what that brown area right there, and you'll see when Jan talks about some of the wind energy projects that are coming up, those are pretty much in, out towards the Tehachapi area in those areas there, which are outside of those solar energy zones. Nonetheless, we're seeing a ramp up from the federal side as well as from the state side. And to include, the state came up last year, I think actually it was 2011, with the Desert Renewable Energy Conservation Plan. That's another practice or initiative, if you will, to streamline this permitting process, to look at the biology and help, again, fast-track some of these projects. And it's going to include 22 million acres of potential land out there that could be used or cited for renewable energy. So if you recall from last time when we talked about those large utility scale renewable energy projects, the solar, thermal, those that are primarily regulated under the umbrella of the CEC. We provide our regulatory controls to them, get those folded into their permitting process, and on goes the projects. Well, today we're going to talk about the photovoltaics and also wind energy, which are not under that overall umbrella, and we're issuing our water quality controls through 401 certs, dredge and fill permits individually for each of those projects. Still a significant amount of work either way you slice it. So to the outline, here's what we have in store for you today. Jan Zinnemann from our Victorville office will talk about wind energy, followed by Alan Miller from the Tahoe office on photovoltaics. And then we've got Craig Bailey, who's a staff environmental scientist from Fish and Wildlife, to talk about renewable energy development in California. And then I'm going to close with some minor comments on some of the challenges that we're working through. So that's the outline that we have, and I will have Jan come up and start with her presentation.
Good morning. I'm Jan Zimmerman. I work out of the Victorville office. I'm an engineering geologist. And I'm going to talk to you today specifically about the wind energy projects that we've seen in the region. So just an overview of what I'm going to talk about, you know, is the same adage. Tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them again. So we're just going to go through the slides here. We're going to discuss where's the wind development in the region and what are the main components of individual wind projects. And then we'll look at what are the beneficial uses of the surface waters in the region where the wind development is occurring, and what are the potential water quality concerns that we're aware of. Then we'll talk about how many projects have we permitted so far, and what are the specific challenges that we've come across through that permitting process. We'll also talk in general about the regulatory tools that are applicable to both wind and photovoltaic projects, and then we'll transition over to Alan's presentation. So wind development in the Lahontan region began in the early 1980s in an area known as the Tehachapi Wind Resource Area. This area includes portions of the Antelope Valley and the Fremont hydrologic units. These are closed, internally draining basins. The majority of the power generated in the Tehachapi Wind Resource Area, I was surprised, is delivered to users in the LA Basin. And other wind resource areas in California are in San Gorgonio Pass, Riverside County, and Altamont Pass in Northern California. So the legend over here on the left are the different wind projects that we're aware of. The yellow areas, generally this yellow in here, are the older projects from the 80s. Most of that is built out with wind projects. Some of them are currently operating, and some of them are obsolete. They're not operating. The other wind projects are new projects. Some of them are under construction. Some of them are built and online, and some of them are still being planned. So as you can see, I don't have a scale on this map, but they're large. The average wind project is about 6,000 acres. Some of them are in excess of 10,000 acres. So who's the major proponent for wind development? We're noticing that Southern California Edison is really sort of spearheading the effort in some respect, and has recently executed several power purchase agreements for most of the projects shown on the map. And they're also looking to purchase an additional 1,500 megawatts for new projects that aren't that are still being planned. So you might wonder how is all of this energy going to be delivered? Well, SCE again is implementing a Tehachapi Renewable Transmission Project. And they're planning new substations, upgrades to existing utility lines, and so forth. It's a multi-regional project. It involves areas in Lahontan, the Central Valley, and the Los Angeles Basin areas. So there's three new substations planned, the black squares, and then over 40 miles of new transmission line to deliver that power to the users. So what are the individual components of a wind project? Well, this map is an example of a project that we permitted. This is the Manzano, or the PDV, wind project. The project boundary is the yellow hashed line, and the project area totals about 7,000 acres. Within the project boundary, there are the individual wind turbines, these little teeny tiny green dots. And then the black lines are the access roads, or the road network that is access to the individual turbines and then through the site. There's also underground and overground, underground and overhead utilities shown by the orange here, and then the blue, kind of hard to pick out. We're seeing that some of the other projects, though, are co-locating the underground utilities in the disturbed areas of the roads. So that's one way that the developers are minimizing potential impacts. But I just wanted to point out that the total acreage of the project is 7,000 acres. But once it's constructed, there's only about 418 acres of that will actually be disturbed. Well, that's the main take-home point. So just to give you a little more detail on the individual components of a wind project, the wind turbines themselves are micro-sited based on meteorological data. There's a sort of this round turbine pad, 150-foot diameter turbine pad, and the tower is in the center pad. These are the turbine... The rotor blades, each are about 150 feet long. You can see for scale down here, the truck, little bitty truck. This is one section of tower, and three sections of towers make up a single turbine. Just to point out, one turbine, one 1.5 megawatt turbine can power about 500 homes a year. Pretty impressive. When each project, we have some developers here, and each project themselves have 100 to 200 turbines, so that's a lot better. So the road network, this is another project. This is the Windstar project, an aerial photograph that was taken in 2011 while it was under construction. So these sort of, I call them the round nodes, these are the individual turbine pads and then the access roads to and through the site. This project is in the foothills. It's not flat, it's sloping. You can see the drainages, the creeks, and these heavily vegetated riparian areas. We're finding that most of the impacts from the wind projects are where roads cross the drainages. For the most part, the individual wind turbines can be micro-sited outside of the drainage. So the developers have been pretty good at shifting their locations, and so the impacts are mostly where the roads cross. So, ancillary to the wind, you have to collect the energy and then you have to distribute it. So, as we discussed earlier, SCE is constructing new lattice towers, they're upgrading and building new substations, they're installing overhead utilities, and then to manage all of that, they need to build new roads or upgrade existing roads. So what are those water resources that we see in the Tehachapi Wind Resource Area? Well, like we discussed, they're internally draining basins. We have Cottonwood Creek, Oak Creek, Ash Creek, Pine Canyon Creek. We have a number of playas. There's Rosamond Dry Lake, there's Rogers Lake, and Cohen Lake. And very few of these water bodies are specifically identified in the basin plan. But the wind development essentially covers the whole spectrum of water resources from headwater streams all the way down to the playas. This feature here is the Garlock Fault. And it's a pretty predominant feature, and there's some well-developed springs and wetlands around that fault. So we've got Cottonwood Creek and Oak Creek and Cache Creek, and these are some of the named few in the basin plan, and all of the other surface waters, other than the playas are essentially identified as minor surface waters and minor wetlands. But nonetheless, they're all assigned beneficial uses, and our job is to protect those beneficial uses. The most important functions that we see for these streams is that they provide the hydrologic connectivity between the headwaters and the basin. So following rain events and major storm events, though most of the time they may be dry, they do convey a considerable amount of water from the mountain front to the basin. They facilitate the movement of water, sediment, nutrients, debris, wildlife, and plant life throughout the watershed. So what are the beneficial uses? Well, we go to the basin plan, and it's all right there. We've got groundwater recharge. These are sandy bottom channels. We have groundwater recharge primarily occurring at the mountain front once the water gets to the playa. The predominant volume is evaporated. We also have freshwater replenishment. And, water recreation. There's the Pacific Crest Trail. It goes through the middle of some of these wind projects. The crest, the trail crosses adjacent to headwater streams and wetlands and meadows and all of that, all of which are waters of the state. There's also habitat beneficial uses. There's wildlife, there's warm and cold and rare. And here's this happy little guy just hanging out, waiting for the next rain to come. There's also water quality enhancement. There's tremendous resources in wetlands, and the wetlands provide for cycling of nutrients through the system. They provide water quality enhancement and attenuate peak floods flows and provide storage capacity as well. So what are the potential water quality concerns that we see from the wind development? Well, our experience has been that the majority of the impacts are where the streams, where the roadways cross the streams, because the other portions of the project, the developer has been pretty well at siting the turbines outside of the creeks, moving the buildings so they're not impacting the wetland. This is up here is an example of a creek, and then the roadway that crosses the creek. There was actually a culvert that was installed to convey flows beneath the roadway so that traffic could pass safely from one turbine to the other. Construction can also result in a loss of wetland area or function and value, loss of habitat and recreational uses. But for the wetland, we really work hard with the developers so that those areas were avoided. We also have the potential for hydro modification. When you install the culverts, you might constrict flows that would cause an overall degradation to the stream channel, or reduce flood attenuation is another concern that we have. So how many projects have we permitted? Well, since 2006, we've permitted 10 wind projects. With the exception of the yellow down here, we didn't permit any of these projects. They were built in the 80s. But we did permit this little one right up here in 2006. So in total, the projects we've permitted combined acreage is 61,000 acres. And the energy produced by those projects totals 2,500 megawatts of energy. With those permits, we've authorized 51 acres of permanent impact to waters of the state, which, you know, I didn't do the math, but, you know, that's a relatively small percentage compared to the overall project footprint. We've also authorized 148 acres of temporary impact. We've got two projects that we're currently reviewing, which will add an additional 7,100 acres of footprint and over 400 megawatts of energy. So what are the challenges? Well, there's been a couple of challenges, I might say. The biggest challenge is education and outreach. We've been heavily involved in commenting on CEQA documents. We get the notice of preparation. We let them know what our concerns are. We get the draft EIR. We review it, and we make specific comments on ways to avoid or minimize impacts. But the big thing is defining waters of the state. You know, the definition of waters of the state is very broad. You know, essentially it's all surface and ground waters. And I guess we could talk all day about that, but generally we look for indicators of flow. We don't say, hey, you know, like, you know, sheet flow is a water of the state, but we look for, you know, some form of channelized flow to say that, yes, this is a water of the state and is an area that we would consider regulating discharge to. The other challenge is beneficial use. So oftentimes we're pointing the project proponents and their consultants and the local agencies to the basin plan and describing to them the beneficial uses and the function and values that we have for ephemeral channels and intermittent streams. The other challenges that we face are working with the developers to avoid and minimize. I'm proud to say that out of that 61,000 acres, there's been over 10 acres of wetland identified, and all of that wetland has been avoided. The other challenge is that for each of the projects, the Army Corps has determined that none of the waters are waters of the U.S. So that means that the whole negotiations with the dischargers to avoid and minimize and mitigate, that burden falls on Water Board staff without the support of U.S. Army Corps and U.S. EPA. And then mitigation. We require compensatory mitigation for the permanent impacts, and it's been difficult finding appropriate mitigation for the impacts that are authorized. So what does our regulatory toolbox look like? Well, I sound like a broken record, but we avoid the impact first, and then we minimize, or we negotiate with the discharger to minimize to the extent practical, and then for all unavoidable minimized impacts, we require some form of mitigation. For the impacts to waters of the U.S., our tools are Section 401 of the Federal Clean Water Act, for dredge and fill discharges to the surface waters. And then the construction is regulated under the Construction Stormwater General Permit, Section 402. Like we discussed, though, we can't use that tool because the Army Corps said they're not waters of the U.S. So our tool, it has been the Port of Cologne, where we have several options. We can adopt individual dredge and fill waste discharge requirements, or we can enroll the developers under one of our general permits, and the one we've been using is the R6T2003004, which we affectionately call a small construction general permit. But it does allow for minor stream bed alteration. Minor is subjective, and includes stormwater BMP requirements for construction and post-construction. So it's the tool that we have. The other tool we have is our basin plan, which establishes our no net loss wetland policy. And we've successfully implemented that one. So with that, I'd like to hand it over to Alan, and he'll talk to you specifically about the photovoltaic project.
First, are there any questions? Yes.
Jan, on one of your earlier slides titled Road Network, you showed a overview, I think you said from 2011, of what was called the Windstar project.
Yes.
Do you happen to remember who the developer was?
Windstar LLC.
Okay. On your slide for water quality concerns.
Yes, sir.
Could you remind me what hydro modification means?
Sure. It's the modification of a stream channel whereby you would constrict the flows. Maybe a channel is put into a box culvert and you disconnect it from its floodplain. So you're modifying the channel from its natural course. You're modifying the velocities. You're increasing the potential for erosion or siltation upstream or downstream of the project.
And most of the concerns appear to be focused on stream channels. However, aren't we concerned with impacts where the turbine pads are built as far as compaction, the potential for sediment generation and erosion?
There could be a potential. Let's see, I had another slide here. So here we've got a turbine pad. This is the Cameron Ridge project. There's a turbine pad here. There's a stream. They've successfully sited the turbine pad or shifted it outside of the active channel of the stream, but there is a potential for some runoff during a rain event to increase the sediment load to that channel. Generally, the developer will allow vegetation to reestablish. And in the temporary impacted areas, and I'm not sure if this is 150 feet, if all of this is permanent impact, or I can't recall. The temporary impact areas are revegetated by the developer.
Another question. In what form does the permitting process result in? A waste discharge requirement?
It has resulted in the dischargers be enrolled under one of the general waste discharge requirements that we have. So they're an enrollee, but it isn't a general WDR.
I don't recall seeing very many come before this board. Are they administrative in nature?
It's administrative, and Patty signs. It's called a notice of applicability.
Okay. And I was talking to Mike Blaziak earlier about the process, and I think he said that a lot of times we only hear about the project through the CEQA process.
Yes, that's usually the first time that we become aware of a project, unless the developer reaches out and contacts us first.
Okay. So it's oftentimes, for instance, the Kern County Planning Department will notify us?
Yeah, they'll send out, the State Clearinghouse is sort of the publisher for the CEQA documents, and we'll get notice in the mail and move on from there with our comments.
Okay. No more questions. Thank you very much. Good presentation.
Further questions from the board?
I have a couple questions.
Yes.
Jan, do we also regulate their operation? Do these facilities enroll under the industrial stormwater permit at all?
They're not a recognized industry in the industrial stormwater permit. And then, again, they're not discharging to waters of the U.S., so technically that MPDS permit is not applicable.
Okay, so there's no threat to groundwater from these facilities? There's nothing that comes off them or...?
I would have to ask one of the operators here, but I think there are some oils. You know, there's gasoline associated with the trucks, but for the most part, the rotors, the turbine head, or whatever you call it, there is some oils, but I don't think they're PCBs or anything like that. No, just oils.
Okay, and then you talked about the collection and distribution systems. Do we have jurisdiction over that, or is that CEC that, are we getting any assistance from them?
Those are multi-regional projects, and the State Board has been permitting those through coordination with us. So we've been providing them guidance on issues in Lahontan, but they've been issuing waste discharge requirements to the Southern California Edison for those projects.
And then you mentioned our use of the small construction permit. Do you have any recommendations for changes that would assist us in permitting these projects?
Well, that permit is old. I can't remember, from the 90s? 2003, there you go. 2003-004. I think that it could be revamped to better address the issues that are specific for dredge and fill for waters of the state that are not also waters of the U.S. It could be a better tool.
Thank you.
Good morning, Board Chair and members of the board. I am Alan Miller. I'm the Senior Water Resource Control Engineer in your South Lake Tahoe office. While they're loading the slide presentation, I would just like to point out for those who are following along with the minute presentations that were provided, they were stapled out of order, so you'll want to skip like 8-9 pages ahead to my presentation so that you can follow along with the slides if you'd like. Okay. So I'm going to be talking about photovoltaic power projects in our region. And my overview will talk about what photovoltaic is, what that means, where are some of these projects located, what is included in a photovoltaic project, what some of the potential water quality impacts and regulatory tools that we have for working on those projects. And then I'm going to talk about a few of the projects that we've reviewed and permitted and some of the requirements and what we might expect in the future. So to answer the question, what is PV? It's photovoltaic cells are made out of silicon, and it's a property of the material that allows sunlight to be converted into electricity through these materials. These cells are wired together into, these cells here are small and they're wired together into panels. These panels are then wired into arrays, and then these modules are mounted typically towards the sun. They then go through an inverter that converts the direct current generated into alternating current that can be used in the grid, and then that is put to either the grid or some load at your house. So that's the way PV works. Mike talked a little bit about some of the energy planning, about the Department of Energy across these six southwestern states. I'd just like to mention that, you know, these red areas are the areas that are most suitable for solar development. You can see there's some very deep red in our area. And I would just like to point out that with the Department of Energy and the BLM controls large areas here, and in fact, recently concluded a planning document that Mike mentioned for 17 solar zones. Originally, BLM was going to open up 80 million acres to solar development in these six states. They've now narrowed that down to 280,000 acres in 17 solar development zones, working with environmental entities. And that's in recognition that there's going to be a lot of utility-scale solar developed and that it needs to be sited responsibly. And so we are working with BLM as a partner, although not closely. they're working because they are the major land manager. So that's the slide. This is a slide that shows some of the planning that's being done by Kern County. And wherever you see a black dot on this, that's a planned photovoltaic project. And this is in Kern County. Also, you'll see that there are a couple of there's anything that's a proposed or approved project is a bullet or a star. There are some electrical substations as well that are planned, and I'm trying to remember exactly where those. I think there's one right there. So there's a couple of electrical substations in that. The typical components of a photovoltaic project would be the photovoltaic panels themselves, which again are mounted atop some sort of a bounded base. The road network the transmission lines associated with the power, and then the staging area or the connection areas that they would need to make. This is a not a project in our region, but this is an example of you know, the large-scale PV development. And the hydrologic modifications that Mr. Dias asked about, I think I would characterize them a little bit more broadly than just impacting the streams, because I would agree that when you start building, you know, concrete pads 150 feet in diameter and so forth, you might be changing the actual infiltration and runoff patterns of an overall site, and that can also be considered hydro modification. But the general types of effects are, as mentioned, mass grading and soil compaction from that activity, the discharge of dredger-filled materials to streamways, and then increased runoff, erosion, and sedimentation from that compaction and mass grading. Additional water quality impacts on beneficial uses would be the loss of aquatic or other terrestrial habitat and the associated beneficial uses, as well as loss of recharge and replenishment that can affect things like industrial and municipal power supply and water quality enhancement. The other thing, I just included this slide just to show that, you know, these desert washes are dry when they're dry and they're not when they're not, and people often forget that. And so, you know, you can see that they're a little bit mired in the muck here. And so the thing that we're trying to do is to reinforce that when these things flow, they got to be, you got to get out of the way, and if you don't, you'll suffer the consequences. And you know, the regulatory tools that we use are the same as Jan mentioned. We have the Clean Water Act permits where they're applicable, coverage under general WDRs elsewhere, and we do try to ensure that the stormwater BMPs are put in during and following construction. Oftentimes, in addition, the county planning or other planning agencies will include mitigation measures as a requirement of CEQA. In some cases, we can enforce those through terms in our water quality certification, things like that. And then we have implementation monitoring that we can prescribe as well for our general orders. One of the things that we like to see is a lot of rooftop and parking lot solar projects, because we ordinarily do not regulate these. They're sited on existing developed properties, and it's kind of a win-win because you're providing shade for cars and you're, you know, not increasing impervious surface or impacting waterways. So there's a lot more potential solar development for rooftop and parking lot solar. We'd like to see a lot more of that. The other types of things that we're seeing are in water-short areas, on ag lands. The ag lands can be converted to PV projects, and so on this map, this is showing a 650 megawatts of planned development over 4,782 acres in Antelope Valley. Wherever you see these colored areas, that's some phase of a future planned PV project. So, you know, kind of a checkerboard pattern here on the existing ag lands. CEQA was mentioned as our primary way to find out about these projects. In my unit alone for these photovoltaic projects, we've reviewed something like 63 documents. On those, about half of those we've sent comments to the lead agency. And so far, we've just sort of seen the tip of the iceberg here on applications received. We've gotten in process four. And we've also reviewed a couple of projects to tell them that we didn't think they had any water resources that were of concern to us on their property. And then we have expectations for about eight applications over the next 2 to 3 years. So I'm going to talk just a little bit about some of the projects that we have issued permits for, the Victor Phelan, the Rosamond, the Beacon, and the Catalina projects. I'm only going to discuss the first three. Victor Phelan was a project within Adelanto. It's about 10 miles west of Victorville in San Bernardino County. This is a fairly small 20 megawatts on 160 acres. There were no U.S. waters identified by the Army Corps, so it's being permitted under general waste discharge requirements. It has one major wash and several minor washes with mass grading proposed and a road network. And in this case, it's in the Mojave watershed, and the mitigation proposed was to do some invasive species removal along the Mojave River. And in this particular case, you can see here's Victorville, here's the Victor Phalen site. There's also a transmission line corridor associated with construction of a new transmission line for that. Here's the site and the transmission line shown in a larger scale. This is a blow-up of that. So you can see these are the several minor drainage ways that are going to be impacted. And so this is the major one that's shown there in blue. And so, they had to mitigate for the loss of those waterways. The Rosamond 1 of 2 projects are west of Rosamond, and they're in Kern County. It's 40 megawatts on about 320 acres. Again, no U.S. waters identified by the Army Corps, so it's under a general WDR. There is one wash impacted, and again, the mass grading. And in this case, the mitigation was acquisition, preservation, and enhancement of off-site land. So they weren't going to try to maintain this in any way. And so this would just be lost and would not be, on the landscape anymore. The Beacon Solar Project is 4 miles north of California City, about 15 miles north of Mojave in Kern County. It's a larger 250 megawatts on 2,300 acres. Two washes were avoided and impacts only from the road crossings. Again, mitigation, acquisition, preservation was proposed for off-site lands. And on this site, here we have a simulation of what it looks like now and what it will look like after the development. So here you can see these are our former ag lands, and that's the pre-development state. And then down here you can see there will be significant solar developments, but they have left some open spaces here, and those are to allow for the drainage way that comes through. So here's a more detailed example or map of that project site. There's a railway that runs through, and then there's this Pine Tree Creek wash that comes through. It's actually a named wash, and it flows on through to Kern-Cone Lake in certain events. But what they're planning here is to leave this corridor open for the flooding, and where there's other shallow flooding, that'll just wash across the site to a certain extent, very shallow flooding. But they're not going to try to modify the hydrology or redirect it in any way. They're just going to try to keep it sort of flat, so, and this is a relatively flat site, as you saw, so that water can kind of spread out, percolate in. But there is this concentrated drainage, and they are going to avoid that. And this just shows a little bit more the different. Here's the project area, so there's little fingers feeding in, and then here's Cone Lake down here. That's the ultimate receiving water. Here, a little bit better idea of some of the water flowing. We have a minor wash here. Again, they'll do some road crossings, but they're going to leave this guy pretty much alone. And one of the things that they did is a hydrologic evaluation. Here in the upper photo, they're showing the existing condition and the velocities of the water flows across the site associated with Pine Tree Creek are shaded from blue to red, depending on how high the velocity is. So the velocities are higher in the red and yellow areas. And you can see the post-project, modeling is intended to demonstrate that they're actually not increasing the velocities. In many cases, they're decreasing them or they're staying the same. You can see there's less red, less yellow, and more blue. So they're just showing that they're not going to increase erosion through this project as a result of these drainage modifications. And you can see that there will be solar stuff sited in this larger floodplain area, but it's going to be shallow flooded and should be able to manage the site around whatever flooding does occur intermittently. Here's an example of the smaller drainage channel on the site. At the lower part here is the other side of that. Then we get over to Pine Tree Creek Wash, and you can see it's quite a bit larger. It's very wide here with a bank over 7 feet high here. So there are significant water flows that come through. Projects in the planning phase include the State Line Solar Farm Project, which would be a much larger project, 300 megawatts on 2,143 acres of BLM land. It's at the California-Nevada border in the Ivanpah Valley, or Ivanpah. And we have Recurrent Energy as one of our permittees for a couple of these projects, and they have some other sites that they're working to develop a total of 988 megawatts on over 1,000 acres in Kern County. So more stuff coming. Again, we had the 30 large projects that we commented on, and this would be the State Line Solar Project, State Line Solar Farm. So that concludes my presentation portion, and unless there are any questions.
Questions? Yes.
Alan, regarding the Beacon Solar Project, slide 22 and several following it. As I recall, originally this was proposed to be a solar thermal project. It wasn't PV.
My staff would be better able to answer that. I think this is the one that it did start out as a CEC project, and then they decided to do photovoltaic, which the CEC doesn't regulate, and so it did fall to us. That's my recollection.
Yeah. Okay.
So the CEC is not involved in any of these projects that I mentioned.
Okay. And I was a little surprised the Ivanpah project falls within our region. It's not Colorado River.
A little bit north, I think.
Okay. And on your slide, I think 5, that's it. The project in the northwest corner called Fremont Valley Preservation.
Here?
Yeah. Do you know what phase of the review process that's in?
I'm not familiar with that project. Maybe one of the other staff could speak.
We recently received the notice of preparation of a draft EIR for that. And Toby Tyler in Tahoe commented on that.
As I recall, this is a very unique project. It's very large and subtle photovoltaic, but it also includes some water banking aspects of Owens Valley water and even some groundwater injection.
Yeah, there was another slide that actually showed up on, I think. Right here, again, this is is this the same project? No, different project. Okay, we have a similar project in Antelope Valley as well that involves water banking on a PV site. So we are seeing these sort of co-located uses.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions?
No more questions. Thank you very much, Al.
Okay, with that, I'll turn it back over to Jan.
Thank you.
Sorry, if you could toggle back to the presentation on the wind packet, and it should be in slide 17, it should be on page 9. That's where we'll start. So, thank you. Glad to be here again. I just wanted to just briefly go over our mitigation approach and highlight some of the mitigation that we've accepted for the projects that we permitted, and then touch briefly on the lessons that we've learned. So our mitigation approach applies to impacts to waters of the state. So for all permitted impacts to waters of the state, we require some form of preservation, enhancement, and or restoration. We encourage the the mitigation to be on-site so that the mitigation is as close to the source of impact as possible. If that's not available or is not feasible, we prefer the mitigation to be in the same watershed so that the watershed benefits from the mitigation. But we're finding that, particularly in the Antelope and Fremont watersheds, that there's a lack of formal mitigation banks and in-lieu fee programs that would be associated with waters of the U.S., and that the resource conservation districts are great to work with, but they have limited resources. So the mitigation for the developers off-site is becoming a little bit more challenging. We also coordinate very closely with our friends and staff with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. They've been great, and we've coordinated to the extent that some of the developers' mitigation would satisfy the requirements of both agencies. We've also started using the Army Corps' guidance on determining mitigation ratios. This is an effort that came out last year, early 2012, that is to sort of make the whole determining the mitigation ratio transparent, that process transparent, and provide the justification for the ratios that you're requiring of the developers. It also takes into account the function and value of the resource that's being impacted, and then the benefit you're going to get from the mitigation. So for the individual projects, we require a mitigation monitoring plan. And in that plan, they need to identify sufficient acreage of waters of the state that will be used as mitigation. It's either on-site or off-site. It needs to be protected in perpetuity, so no development in the future, so those beneficial uses are protected. We require specific enhancement or restoration activities be detailed for us so we know how those beneficial uses and waters will be enhanced or restored. And then a monitoring and reporting program with success criteria. So the developers, they go out and they do the mitigation. How is it functioning? Is it moving along at the speed or at the desired criteria to enhance and restore over usually a five-year period? And then we get annual monitoring reports that report back to us the success. Or if there's not meeting the criteria, then they define, you know, how they're going to better change their activity so that they can enhance. This long-term management plan is something new that we're considering, where following the 5 years of mitigation, that the owner will then provide some long-term management of that property. That would also include some funding or proof of funding that management will proceed in the future. So if we can't get the monitoring plan, fortunately for all of the wind projects, we've been able to secure a monitoring plan before the permit is issued. But if for some reason the developer can't come up with the mitigation monitoring plan, in two instances, we have required a letter of credit at a certain amount of dollars as a financial assurance that the mitigation will occur. I don't know all the details on that, I'm sorry, but hopefully if there are any questions on that, Alan Miller can answer those questions. So the mitigation highlight. So we've permitted 10 projects and 10 wind projects and 4 photovoltaic projects. And with that, there has been or authorized 58 acres of permanent impact to waters of the state and 160 acres of temporary impacts to waters of the state. As a result, we've required the developers to enhance or restore over 84 acres of desert wash 64 of those acres, shown here in the green triangles, are on individual project sites. So this particular project is mitigating 20 acres of waters of the state on the site. 20 acres are mitigated off-site through the Antelope Valley Conservancy and the Mojave Desert Resource Conservation District. The lands with Antelope Valley Conservancy are in the blue triangles. This one is on Big Rock Wash, and I can't remember what this one is called at the moment. We've also got 18 acres not shown on this map with Mojave Desert Resource Conservation District, which is tamarisk removal along the Mojave River and the Mojave River watershed. So for all of the temporary impacts, we've required the developers to regrade and revegetate using a native seed mix. So the regrade is to pre-project conditions and then seeding and monitoring to make sure that that vegetation grows back. So what are the lessons that we've learned? Well, this is just a handful from Jan. I'm sure we could all add to the bucket. But the big one is to initiate communication early on with the developers in the planning stage. So we really need to make sure that we comment on the notices of preparation, that we provide specific comments on the draft EIR. We need to get from the generic to the specific, and then review the final EIRs to make sure that they've incorporated our comments. I've also found that performing pre-application site inspections, so going out with the developers and the consultants and walking up a wash and defining this is where we would call our jurisdiction, this is what we would define as a water of the state, and find that that's been very useful once we get the application better describes the impacts to waters of the state and quantifies what is on the project. The other lesson learned is that mitigation is just becoming increasingly challenging. We need to find creative tools to focus our mitigation efforts because some of the projects have small areas of impact, so the mitigation itself is relatively small. So we have these sort of little fragmented areas of mitigation, and if we had some way to focus that on a larger resource, I think that the watershed might benefit a little better for the smaller projects. And then, lastly, coordinate closely with other agency staff, particularly California Fish and Wildlife and Army Corps staff, where there are waters of the U.S., but they really are our partners, and we share jurisdiction. Our jurisdictions overlap, and so if we work closely with them, I think it's better for the developer and it's better for the regional board because it helps us develop those relationships. So with that, I would like to invite Mr. Craig Bailey from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife to speak.
First, are there any questions from board members? Yes.
Jen, could we look at your slide 20, please? The mitigation land... of the total 84 acres of mitigation land required, 64 acres were located within the watershed of the impact.
Within the project boundaries.
Even better.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we had to go out of the watershed completely to get the other 20 acres.
Yes. There were a couple of projects where we accepted mitigation in the Mojave watershed. That mitigation was justified by a higher mitigation ratio because it was outside of the watershed.
I understand. And it's good that there is some benefit somewhere in Southern California
yes.
for this particular disturbance. But I would, ideally, I'd like to see 100% of the mitigation done in the same watershed where the disturbance occurs.
Yeah. I agree with you completely.
What's the limitation? Why have we been unable to do that?
Part of the problem is that there may not be resources on in the project site itself that can be enhanced or restored, or maybe not sufficient acreage to satisfy the mitigation ratio that we're requiring. Part of it might be that the developer would prefer not to have the responsibility of doing the mitigation themselves, so they look to an off-site source, which is acceptable. But the resource Antelope Valley Conservancy, these two projects essentially wiped them out. They're to full capacity at this point. There is another transitions habitat that we are starting to learn about, and they do provide mitigation lands in the foothill areas. So that's an option that we'll need to pursue and help the developers come up with better options in the watershed. But right now we're limited because we don't know where to start.
And I think you said that you've been working with the local resource conservation districts.
Mm-hmm.
There is an Antelope Valley
Conservancy
RCD.
Yeah.
And there's also in the same watershed, there's the Eastern Kern County RCD.
Okay. I have not worked with them, so
okay.
That's good.
Yeah, they're available. Much of their jurisdiction extends outside the watershed, but some of it is in the northern portion.
Right.
And their office is in Ridgecrest.
Well, good. We'll certainly coordinate with them and see if they have some ideas for us.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you. Now we'll move on to Craig.
I just want to offer, do we want to take a quick 5-minute break right now before we start into the rest of the presentation, or we can continue on? It's up to the board.
We'll take a 5-minute break.
All right.
Bless your heart, Mike.
Like our regular breaks, so we say 5 minutes.
We're very excited about this presentation.
Well, I was thinking, I've got some projects in Alpine County, aren't we?
I know. See, you and I are both doing the same thing over here.
Well, they're turning.
We'll come back into session, and we're covering item 11.
Right. This is the Christmas part of this presentation, where we have, you know, we're blessed with having Craig Bailey from Fish and Wildlife come here from the Fresno office to talk about the coordination they're doing and their part in this renewable energy process. So I'll turn it over to Craig.
Good morning.
Good morning.
As Mike said, my name is Craig Bailey, and I'm a staff environmental scientist with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife for Central Region, also known as Region 4. As you've probably heard, we've had a name change. We used to be the California Department of Fish and Game, but our mission remains the same, and that's to protect California's fish and wildlife resources for its citizens. So just a quick little bit of background about how we're organized. We have 7 regions, the Central Region, which is Region 4, the South Coast Region, which is commonly called Region 5, and the Inland Deserts Region, which is commonly called Region 6, are the regions that deal with renewable energy development in the desert. We go into Eastern Kern County. The South Coast Region comes up, you know, through the Antelope Valley and LA County, and then the Inland Deserts has the majority of it. All of these regions have dedicated renewable staff. There are 4 dedicated renewable energy positions in Region 4 and at least 2 in Region 5 and Region 6. And although we have 4 full-time people, we keep pretty busy. We currently have had over 250 projects consult with us in some form or fashion. That can include folks that have just come in and rolled out a map and said, we're thinking about a project here. Can you give us some early feedback? To projects that are actively in the CEQA process or applying for permits or have their permits and are in the compliance phase. Some of these, you know, are very active and are taking a lot of time, and others we haven't heard from in a while, but, you know, haven't officially said that they aren't pursuing the project. And again, there's a lot of diversity with these projects. They range in size from about 20 acres to over 40,000 acres. And I'm sorry that the map didn't show up as well, but as you can see, some of them are in the San Joaquin Valley, but we have a whole lot of wind, which is the light pink, you know, concentrated on that eastern edge of the Tehachapis, and then some solar projects on the floor of the Mojave. So how are we involved in renewable energy development? We're part of the Renewable Energy Action Team, which consists of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Bureau of Land Management, and the California Energy Commission. We comment on projects through the CEQA process. We issue incidental take permits to comply with CESA. As part of the REIT, we're developing the Desert Renewable Energy Conservation Plan, which you heard a little bit about earlier. And then we also issue lake and stream bed alteration agreements to comply with Fish and Game Code. And I'll go into a little bit more detail on some of these things. Oops. So under CEQA, as I said, we review and comment on environmental project documents. Most of our comments deal with mitigation measures to reduce impacts to fish and wildlife resources to less than significant. This can include things such as survey protocol recommendations, you know, suggested methodologies, timing, frequency of surveys, as well as mitigation measures to reduce the overall impact to those resources. We also try to take this opportunity when we're commenting on CEQA projects to make suggestions on how projects can avoid take of listed species or avoid impacts to lake and streams, or at least minimize those impacts. If take can't be avoided, then, you know, an incidental take permit would be warranted to comply with CESA. And I just wanted to take a moment to point out the definition of take, and that means to hunt, pursue, catch, capture, or kill, or attempt to do so. And the reason I wanted to highlight it is, you know, sometimes project applicants will come to us, and as one of their minimization measures, they'll say they're going to put an exclusion fence around a project, or if they see something like a desert tortoise, they're going to move it out of harm's way. You know, those can both, those are obviously, you know, good minimization measures, but technically speaking, that can be capture. And so then that meets the definition of take, and an incidental take permit is warranted. And so that's just one of the things we like to try to communicate with project proponents early, especially in those comment letters that I spoke about earlier. And then the other thing I wanted to say is, I said in the slide, impacts must be fully mitigated, but really, to be technically accurate, it should be take needs to be fully mitigated. There is a fully mitigated standard with CESA. If you're impacting something like foraging habitat or Swainson's hawk, you know, that is something that can be, has the potential to be mitigated through the CEQA process to less than significant by providing replacement habitat, you know, avoiding nests or, you know, meeting the definition of take. So related to endangered species is the Desert Renewable Energy Conservation Plan. As I said, the department is part of the team that's developing this plan. It's a massive effort. It is a combination habitat conservation plan under the Federal Endangered Species Act and NCCP under the Natural Communities Conservation Plan Act. It's the study area, or the planning area, is approximately 22.5 million acres. But in addition to just the massive area of the DREACP, is we're currently considering providing take coverage for up to 160 species, which is a lot. And you know, all those species may not remain on the list, but you know, we're in the planning process, and so they're currently on the list that's being discussed for coverage. What we hope to get out of the DREACP is we want to identify development focus areas that can accommodate between 200,000 and 350,000 acres of renewable energy development. And this is the target because we think this is the amount of acreage that will be required to meet California's renewable energy needs through the year 2040. Also, as part of this plan, we want to identify up to 8.5 million acres for potential conservation. And pre-established mitigation measures for projects that are occurring in those DFAs and participating in the DREACP. You know, the ultimate goal is to provide, you know, streamline a coordinated conservation effort and provide streamlined take coverage for those project proponents participating in the DREACP. So what I wanted to spend most of my time on, and sorry I rushed through some of that stuff, so if there's any questions, feel free to obviously ask me when I'm done, but where most of our coordination happens with the regional board is when we do lake and stream bed alteration agreements. And so Fish and Game Code requires a project notify us if they're going to divert or obstruct flow, modify a bed bank or channel, or deposit debris into a lake, river, or stream. And that includes, you know, I think as was mentioned earlier, you know, a lot of washes that are out here are dry when they're dry, and they can be wet when they're wet. But it really does, we really do consider, you know, perennial, intermittent, and ephemeral features potentially jurisdictional. For us, you know, getting back to our mission statement, our concern is really protecting fish and wildlife resources. So sometimes folks will see a relatively small drainage, a relatively small feature, one that doesn't frequently hold water, and think, oh, is that jurisdictional? And so we always say, you know, it could be. If you have any doubt, notify us. And then, so what happens when we get notified? We have 30 days to determine if a notification is complete or not. If it's incomplete, we'll send a letter back to the applicant and let them know what information they need to provide to make the notification complete. Upon completion, we make one of three determinations. We can determine that it's not jurisdictional, in which case we return the notification fee. We can say it is jurisdictional, but there are no fish or wildlife resources at risk, and so therefore a stream bed alteration agreement isn't warranted, and we'll state that in the letter. Or we can issue a lake or stream bed alteration agreement. And then we have 90 days to get that out to the permittee, and they can either sign it or request edits. One thing I wanted to note was that these timelines refer to regular agreements, but if there's, meaning they're 5 years or less in duration, and if it's a long-term agreement, those time periods don't apply. What we're seeing is most renewable energy projects, at least the ones that I'm working with, are sort of separating their stream bed application process rather than coming in for one long-term agreement. They're saying, you know, can we get a construction permit so we can move forward, and then we'll come back in and apply for a longer agreement for our O&M. And I think a lot of that has to do with their project management timelines. So what's in a lake and stream bed alteration agreement? It's pretty straightforward. Project description, location, you know, what are you doing and where are you doing it, measures to protect fish and wildlife resources, mitigation requirements. As you guys are probably aware, sometimes you can't avoid impacts and they need to be mitigated. And then reporting requirements, you know, did the measures get implemented? Was the mitigation successful? And, you know, has the project been completed? So we outline all that in the agreement. So things that we try to touch bases with the water board and are a big component of a stream bed agreement, you know, are avoidance and minimization measures. You know, they start with environmentally significant areas. You know, if there is a resource such as riparian vegetation or a sensitive vegetative community or a habitat feature of concern, like a burrow or a den, you know, we want those delineated and marked to make sure that, you know, the construction crews are aware of them and can avoid disturbing them. You know, erosion and pollution control, that can include measures such as not working in the feature when it's wet, making sure various materials are stored well away from a feature so there's no runoff concerns or pollution concerns. Part of that, staging areas, parking areas, making sure, you know, you're not parking in the wash, things like that. And then a big component is an education program, and by that I mean a worker education program. We want to make sure that those working on the project know what's in the stream bed agreement, know what it is, and understand the consequences if they fail to meet compliance. Then getting specifically to the, you know, our mission to protect fish and wildlife resources, will often include species-specific measures in the stream bed agreement towards the species we're concerned about. They can include pre-construction surveys. For example, you have a desert wash. Do you have desert tortoises in the wash or desert tortoise dens? We'll outline the survey protocols, methodology we want used, when we want those surveys done, the timing of those surveys. We'll also frequently require that those doing the surveys get approved as a qualified biologist so we know they're capable of doing it. And then other minimization measures, there's a variety of them. They tend to be project specific, but a common one is buffers, for example, avoiding nesting birds, things like that. And then we have, obviously, when impacts can't be avoided, there's compensatory mitigation. So, you know, it can be as simple as temporary impacts, and we just want to see that area revegetated. Or if it's a, you know, riparian vegetation or sensitive plant community, we may want to see restoration activities that go, or if it's a permanent impact, we may want to see restoration activities that go beyond simply revegetating temporary disturbance. That's usually when you see, you know, some sort of ratio, you know, please mitigate riparian, riparian vegetation at 3-1. As part of this, we ask for a revegetation or restoration plan that will outline the seeds and plants that will be used. You know, we obviously want to encourage the planting of native plants and avoid invasive species, so we don't want those things included in the plant palette. Success criteria, we want to know, you know, what, how are you going to measure success, and how are we going to determine that? And then remediation measures. What happens if you're not successful? What are you going to do to fix it? And then, again, if we do feel like we need to mitigate for species impacts, we may put species habitat mitigation measures in there. And an example of that might be is, for example, I think, you know, you may have a wash where the direct impacts are very small. Let's say there is a, you know, you're just doing an Arizona-style crossing through it, and, you know, we think the direct impacts are, we'd agree, are pretty small. If it was just that, you know, it would maybe a fairly simple streambed alteration agreement, or perhaps, you know, we might even, you know, issue a letter saying it's jurisdictional, but an agreement isn't warranted, depending on the project specifics. However, although I should say that latter part's probably in common. But let's say, you know, some projects are fencing their entire perimeter, and that's going through the wash. Well, that wash has habitat value for, let's say, desert tortoise. And so in that case, we may say, well, we're losing those habitat values, which is part of our mission. And so we want to see some habitat compensation someplace else. As part of that, and obviously that makes on-site mitigation challenging, because if your site's fenced, it's the same problem. But that can include some sort of land protection, either through land acquisition or permanent conservation easement. We want to see, as Jan mentioned, a habitat management plan, so that, that we know that the site is going to be managed for the benefit of species, of the species we want to see protected. That can include things, everything from a fencing plan, signage, access plan, trash abatement, monitoring for the species. We obviously want to know, is it using it? Is it responding well to your management actions? Is it not responding well? And then we also use the plan to generate the management fund. We use a program called the Property Analysis Record, or PAR, which is essentially a database program that can estimate long-term endowments. You don't have to use a PAR. You know, an Excel spreadsheet that's formatted appropriately can do the same thing. But we try to think of all the potential costs that can come in, and you know, including drive time to the site and mileage, and you know, all those costs that, that can impact a budget that you know, people may not think about. But we try to include that in the plan, and then, you know, use it to, as the basis for the management fund. As Jan mentioned, you know, we prefer all this be implemented prior to the start of construction activities, but, you know, it's just not possible, and we understand it is a complicated process. So in lieu of implementation, we do accept financial securities. Typically for us, that's in the form of a letter of credit. And then we give the applicant a timeline. We say it has to be implemented by a certain date. And if that doesn't happen, we can cash a letter of credit and basically go find the project ourselves. That's not our preference for a couple of reasons. One, you know, we don't have dedicated staff time to do that, so, you know, it's an additional burden. We'll do it if we have to, but, you know, it's, I think it's better for everyone if we don't. And another reason for our financial securities, we have to assume the absolute worst-case scenario. We have to buy land. What's the most expensive land's going for? We have to do management practices. What's the most expensive that those practices are likely to cost? And so, you know, there's a good chance that the project applicant may be able to find a cheaper solution, in which case they can say, we implemented this, you know, let's cancel a letter of credit and save some money. So that's why we hope it works out better for everyone if they are able to implement it themselves. And one thing I wanted to point out is there is no, even if we require species mitigation through a stream bed agreement. It doesn't provide CESA take coverage. We can only do that through an incidental take permit or an NCCP. And so if, you know, for example, you fenced the site and a tortoise showed up in the wash and you didn't have a take permit, you know, you that would be considered, you know, potentially take. And so we try to work with applicants to either figure out if they need a take permit, you know, if it would be appropriate for the project, or if just doing some, you know, species habitat mitigation is the best route forward. And then finally, I'm probably a couple minutes over, and I apologize for that. But just real quick, you know, I've been coordinating recently with Jan and Toby, and it's been really beneficial for me, and I'm, so I hope you feel the same way. You know, but some of the things that, you know, we've just been talking about is I think we could probably exchange contact information a little better, and I'm talking about the department. For example, I don't think Jan knows that all four of our renewable energy staff, and we're not separated geographically, so there's a chance that I may not be the person working in Eastern Kern County. As she mentioned, continue to communicate about projects and mitigation. I think some folks have felt like maybe we're asking for different things, when really I don't think that's always the case. And I think with a little bit of communication with us and the applicant, we can come up with solutions that meet both of our needs and also provide one option for the applicant. And then lastly, just, you know, again, I found this beneficial, you know, and how can we help you? Is there a way the department can help coordinate you or provide information? We're happy to do that. So with that, I'll wrap it up.
Any questions from board members? Yes.
Go ahead. Do you track bird strikes at wind turbines?
I guess I would say sort of. And the reason I'm saying sort of is we don't have a mechanism to require that type of monitoring. It's done through the CEQA process. So we do make recommendations on wind projects for monitoring suggestions, both to establish a baseline, but also how to monitor post-construction or post-construction mortality. And then, you know, we try to work with the lead agency, whether it's Kern County or another organization, and the applicant to develop mitigation measures.
And what would those be?
You know, we're early on. You know, some of I don't know if I have one that I could recommend that's been proven to be effective. Some of the things that are being discussed are, you know, for example, radar and curtailments, you know, shutting down at you know, particularly high times of activity. So, you know, we're trying to figure out things that work both for the applicants so that, you know, they have a delivery goal, but also, you know, minimize impacts to the resource. I would say it's probably one of the most challenging things about my position right now is figuring out those types of solutions.
Yeah. I'm not knowledgeable about this, but I have in passing read this, that, and the other thing about how bird strikes, especially nighttime migratory birds, are, you know, being killed in the millions. I mean, you know, some of the literature is kind of incendiary, but I don't know what the facts are.
Yeah. I mean, we are, for the projects that are monitoring, some of them we have seen some fairly high numbers of bird strikes, you know. Those that are monitoring are reaching out to us, or at least some of them are, to you know, try to come up with some solutions. And like you said, it's a challenge. You know, they have their goals, and, you know, we're trying to minimize those impacts. But, yeah, you know, I think there was a thought that, you know, things could compare to the Altamont Pass, and at least on some of the reports, the wind farms in the Tehachapi have compared to the Altamont Pass, or been a little higher or a little lower, but, you know, are at least comparable. And so we do have concerns about that, but, you know, we also understand that California, you know, has a mandate to meet these renewable energy goals. We're trying to work with the applicants on what makes the most sense.
I have a question about photovoltaics, and that is, have you any assessment about the benefits or possibly the deficiencies that all that shade brings to the area where these PVs are installed in the vast arrays?
I don't have anything scientifically, and what I mean by that is there are some research. It's my understanding there are some research projects that are getting off the ground that are starting to look at that. But as you know, a lot of this is fairly new, and so there isn't anything that's been. I haven't seen anything that, for example, has appeared in a peer-reviewed journal. You know, I've seen different presentations where people have presented, you know, initial results. You know, showing, oh, they might use part of it. And others say, oh, it looks like they might not. But, you know, I don't, you know, it's you know, the first couple of years of a study, I mean, we really have to, I think, take a little bit of time to see it. For us, you know, conservatively for conservation planning, we have to assume that they're not going to use it in the long term, just because we don't know. And so, you know, if we're permitting a project or moving forward, it's hard to say, well, they might not. So how do we quantify whether that's habitat or not? So in those cases, we're taking the default position of, you know, we don't know if they're going to use it, so we have to assume from an impact standpoint that they might not.
Further questions?
I just wondered if you found anything problematic in terms of separating the permitting from construction to O&M.
No, but it's early in that process. You know, for example, at least for the projects I've worked on, that they've completed they've been issued their stream bed construction, their stream bed alteration agreements for construction. But they're either just started the conversation about their O&M stream bed agreements, or they've yet to submit those applications. And so I'm hoping that you know, that the conversations leading up to it have been positive, and I think we've been on the same page. So I hope that's the case. But I, you know, if you ask me in a year, there's always a potential I could have a different answer. I'm optimistic about it.
Further questions? Thank you.
I have a question. So I was listening with great interest about your desert energy conservation plan. I think that one of the challenges that Jan was talking about with mitigation is for the smaller projects, identifying mitigation, and sometimes what we end up with is all these patchwork spots that were conserving, and it would make more sense if we had the time and energy to do what you're doing, to identify 8.5 million acres that, you know, were situated such that it made a corridor or it preserved a whole watershed. And so I was wondering if, you know, there is some sort of partnership in terms of once you guys finish that, you know, we could also look to those areas and point people to those areas when it's not possible to conserve on-site.
Yeah, I think it would probably depend on what you were trying to accomplish from a regulatory perspective. But when I say, you know, identify up to 8.5 million acres for conservation, that doesn't mean that, you know, when the plan goes in, that's 8.5 million acres that are now under some sort of protection. What the idea is that, you know, by selecting an area that will have the least impact for from a development perspective, you know, and then in exchange, you know, we'll now know where to direct folks for habitat mitigation, you know, and hopefully by keeping people in a, it's weird to say 8.5 million acres is a general area, but in the same general area, that we're getting, you know, folks concentrating on the same movement corridors and on the same, you know, core habitat areas. But I think if, you know, again, I think, you know, Janet and I are finding that there's a lot of overlap when we're looking at something for species and they're looking, you're looking for something to meet your needs. I certainly don't see why you couldn't say, hey, you know, we need to mitigate for impacts to a desert wash. You know, here's an area that has a lot of value under the DRACP. Again, I know all projects, you know, have project-specific needs, and I'm not sure what you'd be trying to accomplish from a regulatory perspective, but if folks want to use it for their own direction or for ideas, well, I'd say just, you know, the more contributing to a global plan would seem better.
So. Yeah, it sounds like you guys have a lot of great tools that we could benefit from, like you mentioned the PAR, and so I think more coordination is just going to be a win-win for both agencies.
Yeah. I mean, that's something I think we're certainly happy to share. You know, we have both positive and negative experiences with land management, and you know, I could probably do a half-an-hour presentation just on that, and so I'm happy to share those. And the PAR, just, you know, is put out through the Center for Natural Lands Management. So it's not our software, but we subscribe to it, so we're able to use it.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. I'm going to conclude with just 3 points, and what I'm going to do here is I'm going to take my slides a little bit out of sequence because I want to make a point that actually to what Kim was just bringing up. In terms of coordination. PowerPoint wizard. Okay. Let's talk about hydro modification management, and somewhat related to how we re-coordinate and get resources to really address or attack the problem efficiently and in a coordinated way. But as just to the background, the hydro modification, and we talked about it a little bit earlier, but it's simply alteration of the hydrology in a watershed. That's all we're talking about here. And you can see that largely on these utility-scale projects. One of the things that strikes you when you look at the map that Jan put up of all the different quilt work of different colors of wind energy projects, notice that there, some of them, or many of them, are contiguous. What is going on, though, from a hydrology standpoint, is they're looking at each project individually. And hydro modification planning is one of the things that needs to be, or management and planning needs to be looked at. And this is something that's new that the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project has put out some documentation on hydro modification management, what's the best way to go. In fact, this is their guidance here on management in California that they put out last year or a year and a half ago. Good information, but it's kind of targeting regulatory agencies and on how we can better use our tools, 401 certs, dredge and fill permits, working with Fish and Wildlife Service, other agencies, planners, to kind of come up with a better assessment of the watershed, of those hydrologic reaches, and also a better management strategy. And then a monitoring plan for those strategies to see whether or not we're effective. So what it's calling for is really a shift from site-specific types of project orientation and focus to a watershed focus. And that comes not only as a solution and a way forward, as they're proposing, but it's also a challenge for us in terms of resources. Because one of the things I think you also will see from this presentation is that we have two people in the region that do this type of work, up in the north and down the south, and that's not their full-time job. On top of that, they're engineers and geologists. They're not biologists. And you can see there's a huge component on this with the biological piece to this. And that's why, you know, Fish and Wildlife Service and us working together is so critical to this. But that's what it brings up, though, not just in terms of renewable energy, but in terms of how we look at development throughout the Mojave Desert, is that we really need to be thinking about hydro modification management and incorporating those principles into what we're doing in the future. And that's a challenge for us. It's a little bit newer. It does require resources, mapping, having a better understanding of the hydrology, and a better way to assess those arid hydrologic environments. And that dovetails into the next slide, which is assessment tools. Because if you look in California, they've got the California Rapid Assessment Method, which is a great way to look at how different fluvial environments are responding. Different indicators will provide you with an assessment of its health. But we don't have that in the Mojave Desert. In the arid environments, that's being developed, though. And this is something that Jan has been involved in, working with the same group, the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project, on what they're calling the Episodic Technical Advisory Committee. And that group is actually looking to make assessments and come up with an index to kind of measure the health of some of these desert washes, these ephemeral channels. And this is something that we've just, within the last year, I would say, been involved in and are going to continue to do. But it's, again, part of that whole coordination thing. You can't manage what you can't assess. And so you need the tools to assess. So, you know, and apart from our traditional tools, these are some things that are being developed right now. And we're involved in that as well. So that's that on those two things. And the last point I'll make on the way forward I think you will see it's obvious that we need to coordinate and put resources towards working with land use planners, in addition to our sister agencies and the federal agencies, to understand projects that are coming down the road and how we can better affect water quality from our perspective, from water quality improvements through our water quality control plans. So that's the way forward, obviously, and then continue close cooperation with them, but also continue to work with the episodic TAC, as I mentioned before, and get involved in some of those organizations that are kind of looking at better ways to manage these resources. So that concludes the overall workshop. I hope this has been beneficial, and I open it up for any other questions that you might have.
Questions?
Nice job.
Nice job.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to move on then.